Unpopular opinion, but
unpopular opinion.
Unpopular opinion.
Unpopular opinion.
Unpopular opinion.
Unpopular opinion.
Unpopular opinion.
You're listening to Unpopular Opinion, a podcast for professionals from all walks of life who want to hear success stories from innovators who've won by taking the path less traveled. In each episode, recovering journalist and content marketer Ashley Amber Saba interviews individuals who have prospered thanks to their genuinely unpopular opinions, despite warnings from naysayers, threats to their careers, and colossal obstacles. All rebels are welcome.
Welcome to Unpopular Opinion. I'm your host, Ashley Saba, and this episode is brought to you by my friends at Audience Ops. Audience Ops is a done-for-you, content-led growth agency that offers case studies, blog posts, and full-service podcast production for professionals looking to launch a podcast like this one. Today, I'm joined by CEO and founder Chris Walker of Refine Labs. Welcome to the show, Chris.
Ashley, pumped to be here. Excited to be on the show and talk through this. What do we got going for the audience today?
Yeah. Well, a lot of my audience probably is knowing you, but I thought we could go a little deeper into you and your background today on the show. But your unique, unpopular take is that marketing is fundamentally broken. You say most B2B marketing isn't actually marketing, and organizations use marketers as sales assistants who just perform lead gen. And if businesses don't change their outlook, they'll continue to run single channel lead gen to appease attribution models. Can you elaborate on how this mindset is hurting companies and how it's also hurting the marketers that work for them?
Yeah, to be clear for everyone, I have, from what people say, I have a lot of unpopular opinions. This is just one of them. But happy to go through into some detail here. Companies have set up their attribution models in what I believe to be old, outdated ways that rely on trackable digital events that get measured by software-based attribution over time. And that type of stuff originated in the early 2010s and has continued. The technology has, quote unquote, gotten better, but the same underlying technology exists. And what's happened during that time is the evolution of the internet, the scale and maturity of the internet, the evolution of social media channels, podcasting, communities like Slack and Discord, Facebook groups, virtual events and things like that have grown a ton. And the ability for a B2B professional to interact with their peers through digital scaled word of mouth has completely changed how people buy. And the funny thing is that the methods that companies use to track and measure the effectiveness of their marketing do not account for any of these things. And so when companies and CFOs and CEOs go back into the boardroom and they try and say, okay, what's working and what's not in our marketing, they rely on a single piece of software typically that has a lot of flaws in measurement, which we publish tons of data, and I'll be presenting more about it in an hour at a live event about the incompleteness of the data that's produced by these tools. And then they use those things to decide where are we going to invest and where are we going to spend our money, because that's what we believe is quote unquote trackable. And so what that does is that forces B2B marketers and other revenue professionals to only focus on things that are trackable by software, which are typically transactional digital activities like lead generation that allow them to get a conversion, measure where that conversion came from, and be able to attribute that inside of their marketing automation platform and CRM. And when you do that, you get a lot of quote unquote leads. It's easy to get leads that way, but it's actually quite difficult to be able to create pipeline and revenue from them, because it's typically marketers going out to get people that are not ready to buy to then pass them to sales so that sales can try and sell to people that don't want to buy right now. And the way that people buy and the way that B2B buyers have evolved in how they buy, they want to buy independently. They want to be able to do research with their own sources that they trust more than sales representatives. And so the way that companies are going to market is forcing people through a linear sales channel, digital marketing tracked event, into a sales conversation when they're not ready, versus allowing the buyer to buy independently, executing marketing activities in the places where people actually are that happen to be untrackable by software-based attribution, and being able to create a go-to-market that is actually effective for how buyers buy today. And we see these negative effects on teams, I talked about the negative effects on the company, a lot of investment going into marketing and lead gen, not producing a lot of results. Customer acquisition cost is very high. We see the negative impact on teams, specifically dramatic sales and marketing misalignment, where marketing is achieving their goal and sales is not achieving their goal because of misaligned metrics. We see it on marketing teams not being able to do innovative things that are most customer focused, like producing content, not looking for direct conversions, ungating content, putting it in places where people actually are. And we see negative impact on customers. We see B2B companies trying to sell to people that don't want to buy, hiding like important content behind forms in order to be able to track it, cold calling people that didn't ask for it, and a lot of other company-centric rather than customer-centric activities, all rooted in the way that companies measure and evaluate the effectiveness of their marketing and sales.
And I think you've talked a lot about this too, but it also kind of puts marketing and sales at odds with each other, kind of fighting for credit on things instead of doing what's better for the company.
100%. The way that companies have decided, and this is not every company, but the way companies have traditionally done it and the way a lot of companies still do it today, is to look at the amount of revenue, quote unquote, sourced by the department. So did the SDR get that deal, or did marketing get that deal, or did our sales team get that deal? And then they use that individual touch point to attribute credit to determine how people's compensation is measured and given out, how budget is allocated for the following year, whether budget requests in period or inside of the year to get more additional investment to increase results or try and grow things are decided based on that type of measurement. And it actually takes it super internal of like, which of our teams did this rather than all of our teams working together to do what the customer wants. And so we've suggested an alternative instead of looking at what department did it, looking at what was the way that the buyer converted into pipeline. And when you look at it from the buyer's perspective, it takes all of the emotion out of which department sourced it, because we all know that during any individual channel or any individual buying process, the customer is going to go to the website, they're going to talk to a salesperson, if they close, they're going to interact with CSMs, they're going to see content and word of mouth from peers and colleagues online. All of these things are going to happen that contribute to somebody buying. So, and we know that all of these things contribute. So why are we trying to give credit to one single department over this? Let's acknowledge that every department, it's 2023, every single department in the company is in some way influencing and driving net new revenue and expansion and NRR for customers. And why don't we instead look at what are the best paths that we want customers to come through that indicate that they have a high level of buying intent, that they have short sales cycles, that they have high win rates, they have strong pipeline velocity, that our sales team is productive, that our marketing ROI is strong. Why aren't we looking at it based on how the buyer is converting? For example, from websites, from events, from intent data driven outbound through our partner channel. Why are we looking at it that way versus the internal department? I think is another mindset flip that companies could use to eliminate a lot of the internal politics and things like that that are caused by like single touch point attribution.
We all know what you're up to now. Can you kind of catch everybody up on your history of different jobs and how that has taken you to your opinions today?
I studied biomedical and electrical computer engineering in college. So I have this sort of like foundation of statistics, the scientific method, how systems engineering works, things like that. I spent the next 4 years of my career in business management consulting, working in operations, supply chain, product development, product management, and then marketing. So how are we at, like looking at it at the business level? How are we going to improve gross margins? How are we going to improve time to cash? How are we going to effectively go and bring this new product to market so that we know customers want it? How are we going to price it? How are we going to put together a business case to go and spend $3 million on product development to build this product that we're not going to launch for the next 18 months? Got a lot of solid business foundation there. And over, when I was inside of these companies doing all these different types of projects, the thing that I kept realizing, I probably during that time, I would move every 6 to 12 months to companies. So I spent probably at 5 or 6 B2B companies during that first part of my career. And I saw it over and over again, that these companies are overinvested in sales, that buyers are changing in how they want to buy. And these companies are not effectively doing any type of marketing. They're not creating content. They don't invest a lot on their website. They're not generating revenue through their website. It's all focused on how do we get leads for sales. And you can just see consistently sales productivity going down, revenue starting to flatline or sort of stabilize, or just hitting industry growth targets versus accelerating. And so I saw a lot of those patterns. And at 2015, 16, I effectively bet my career on marketing and what I now call demand creation or demand. And during that time, I was doing marketing for 3 or 4 years. I made like $80,000 to $90,000 a year during that time, while I watched salespeople colleagues make $200,000, $300,000, $400,000 while both of us are contributing to the revenue. I had people come up to me and say, why the fuck are you in marketing? Like, we can get you in the Boston territory right now. We can double your salary overnight. And what I saw during that time in 2018, 17, 18, 19, that the CEO that was trying to pitch me that job didn't see, is that it's going to take him a little longer to realize how much that he needs my skills. He doesn't see it right now, but in 3 years, he'll see that the impact that these types of activities will make will have a dramatically larger impact on overall business growth than one individual salesperson in the Boston territory. So this was an idea of seeing where the future was going, seeing where customers were moving, being focused on my own vision and intuition versus what other people were telling me. And it paid off for me. I started my company in 2019. We've been able to grow rather quickly. We have about 80 super talented people that work here right now. Over the past 4 years, we've worked with more than 200 high growth B2B companies. I've gotten so much experience. I've consulted with CEOs and chief growth officers and chief revenue officers and CMOs and VPs of demand. I've been able to see all these different patterns about what are companies doing that's working? What are companies trying that's not working? How is the budget being allocated? What are the KPIs that they're using? How are they setting up their attribution models? What is the alignment? When does alignment work between sales and marketing? And when does it not? What are the patterns there? And just because of the vantage point that I have working with a lot of companies simultaneously at once, I see a lot of stuff that other people don't see. At least I see it at a level where I have confidence that there's a clear understanding about why it's happening, not just that it's happening. And some of that might be my like engineering background, the scientific method. Some of it might be my intuition. And I'm focused now on trying to create large scale levels of data that support some of the things that I'm talking about, the impact of dark social, how attribution is flawed and incomplete and how most companies do it, how customer acquisition cost gets impacted by certain variables of how companies decide to operate. Even down to the tactical level of what happens for the companies that use Google Performance Max like optimization versus a different level of optimization, how's that impact customer acquisition cost? And that's really like trying to drive the what has historically been a pure art of marketing and trying to move it to a science, and not a science like, oh, we're out there running an A/B test at our company, but looking at it at a large scale with a lot of data across a lot of different organizations, drawing patterns and conclusions based on a large scale data that allow the entire industry to make better, more informed decisions. That's what I'm focused on right now.
In the past, before you started the company, what kind of pushback did you get from individuals at companies when you presented this to them?
Gosh, like pretty much every single angle that any marketer listening to this has gotten. 2017, 18, people laughed me out of the room when I said we're going to sell medical devices using Facebook ads. People laughed me out of the room when they thought that if we made videos for YouTube and LinkedIn, that would help clinical professionals buy our product. That in 2013, 14, that having a great website was more like super important. Got pushback on that. That adding self-reported attribution and getting customer insights is more important than what the attribution software says. That creating pipeline through the website is a great indicator of overall marketing success. I've gotten pushback left and right on anything from the tactical level to the strategic level. And what's happened is that over time, and we're still, I would say that we're still in the early adopter phase relative to the overall market, But over time, more and more people have seen the patterns and recognize that the things that I'm saying and why they're happening are actually true. And they see the problems inside of their business. I know it down to the percentage point of win rates, or MQL conversion rates. And I could be able to communicate that back because I've seen it so many times. It's not it's not dependent on one individual company. It's dependent on how buyers are changing and how buyers want to buy today. Being able to communicate that, they recognize that. They try some of the things that I'm recommending. They have a ton of success. They go and tell other people, and you just get slow, just chip away. And over time, more and more companies will make these transitions. And the people that have made them, I watch companies that have never been a customer of my company before, but have been implementing things that I've been talking about for years. Their marketing team's growing super fast. Their sales team and marketing alignment are great. Their company's exceeding revenue targets year over year, even in macroeconomic downturns like we're facing today. That the CMO who used to challenge the things that I was saying about ungating content is now the biggest proponent of ungating content in a lot of the things that I say. That stuff makes me happy. It's great to see people recognize and see, because I felt the same things in 2017. The sales team looking down on you, people saying, why are you in marketing right now? The CEO like not giving you a $5,000 test budget when they spend $19 million a year on sales to try something new. Like I've been through all of these things. I've proven some of the things out. And now it's great to watch other people take some of the things that I've been saying and implement in their business and have a better results for their company, for their career, and for their customers.
I imagine that feels amazing. People look at you now and they see this guy who's successful, an out-of-the-box thinker, founded a brilliant organization that everybody loves, but it took a lot of guts to do what you did. How do you remain confident in the face of doubt during all of this time?
So first off, I didn't feel like when I was getting ready to start my company, I didn't feel like I was ready. I think a lot of entrepreneurs would echo that. You're never going to feel perfectly ready. And then I tried a couple things. I got a couple customers. And then through the execution of ongoing activities, increased my confidence over time. It's easy to have confidence when things are going well. It's more difficult to have confidence when you're doing all of the right activities and things aren't going well. So it's important to separate from the outcome and focus on the things that you can control and make sure that you're keeping the promises to yourself about the things that you can control. So that's part of the confidence. And then another part is just seeing a ton of people have success. And so for every 99 DMs I get of, hey, I tried that thing. I had tons of success. I got a promotion. I started my company, you know, as a CEO, as my company just raised the next round because of the stuff that you said, we would never be here without the things that you said. Like for the 99 things that I get of that, I get 9, 10, 15, 20 things, people saying you're full of shit. You're a piece of shit. You're arrogant. We hope you fail. And so like it comes in both directions. And the key is to be focused on making sure that there's a lot of people out there that are getting positive impact from the things that I'm saying. If you're going to be a public figure and you're going to try and change a market and you're going to have controversial opinions, people are going to come and say, you're a piece of shit and I don't agree with your stuff. It's been happening since I was a one person consultancy in 2019. And oddly, the negative feedback can become fuel because those people don't understand who I am. They've never tried any of my ideas. They don't know about all the people that have had success doing the things that I'm doing. They don't know about all the people that have worked at my company, came from a shitty job in marketing that they hated, came to my company for 2 to 3 years, learned a bunch of stuff and came out from a company as a marketing manager, 2 years later left my company, is now an SVP of growth or a VP of growth or a chief marketing officer at an early stage company. And those are things that the people that know me see, and the people that don't know me will, you know, hate from afar, and I'm good with all of it.
You definitely have. I've been following you for a little over a year now, and you have a lot of people that like to go on LinkedIn in the comments and tell you how to do your job. And I'm sure a lot of those people haven't had the kind of success that you have had. Do you have any concrete tips you can give people on how to remain calm during that? And I know that a lot of the times you probably don't have to answer any of them because you can just look at what you're doing and that's the proof is in the pudding. But I know occasionally you do respond. Like, what, how do you know when to let it go and when to address it?
So there's an interesting saying that I don't know who it was from. Maybe it was from me, that nobody that's more successful than you is going to waste their time coming in and trying to tear you down in the comments of a LinkedIn post or a TikTok post. Mm. So it's always ankle biters that are trying to pull you down on the way up. And it's when you start to like really internalize that, you realize that it's just because these people, oftentimes it's because people envy, or they see what they could have done in me that they haven't done themselves. So instead of actually going out and saying, hey, I'm going to change my life, I'm going to go and do some of this stuff, because I wasn't like this my whole life. There was a lot of times I lived paycheck to paycheck, had less than $5,000 in my bank account, was afraid I was not going to be able to afford a car payment, like couldn't pay off my student loans. Haven't been like this my whole life. So I know what it's like to be other people. And I've actually hated on people that have been successful earlier on, because I saw that I had the capability to do what they were doing, but I didn't do it. And so it's interesting to sort of look at it in that way. On the way up, there's going to be a lot of people that are trying to pull you down because they're down. So, and how you stay calm in it is basically recognizing that people wouldn't, I spend no time going into a comment trying to make someone feel bad. I'm going to leave my opinion. Some people might think that I'm trying to make someone feel bad. I'm doing it for the followers that are with me, so they can see my point of view on other people's content. But I'm not over there saying someone's a piece of shit, or that I might disagree with what they're saying, but there's a difference there. And then when I respond, I don't think I have like a core formula here, but it's about when I have something to say, and I try and stick to the facts. So that's what happens. But the reality is, if you're posting content, especially on certain platforms, like, it's weird. In 2019, 2020, people were super respectful on LinkedIn. If they disagreed with you, they did it in a respectful way. And then over time, it's become a real dark place that I'm not sure I really like anymore. It's almost equivalent to the stuff you see in TikTok comments, which is sad. It's sad. People attach their professional profile and do some of that stuff in the comments, and it's doing is discrediting themselves. So maybe LinkedIn will pick it up at some point, but as platforms grow, more and more people get on it, you get more ChatGPT type of content, more fluffy, more memes, more of that stuff, which is definitely happening on LinkedIn. So we'll see what happens.
Have you had any mentors in your life that have guided you?
I've had plenty of mentors over time. And it's weird, because while it was happening, I definitely wouldn't have considered them a mentor. I've learned a ton from a lot of people. I think it's really interesting that a lot of people like reach out to me in DM and they're like, I'm looking for a mentor. Will you help me? And I'm like, I post a podcast 3 times a week. I post LinkedIn content almost every day. Like, I don't need to have a one-on-one meeting with you to be your mentor. I'm sharing all this stuff at scale. So there's some people that I've worked with individually, a boss of mine, or the CMO of a company that I worked with, or a CEO that I worked under during management consulting, or a consultant that we hired, things like that. And there's also been people that I just watch their content. I appreciate their perspective, and I can learn a lot of things without ever meeting them or interacting with them in person. So I think there's a key about redefining what a mentor means. And because really, like, even just reading someone's book could be a really strong mentoring opportunity as well. But yes, there's been plenty of people that have helped me along the way, and I'm super grateful for all of them.
Your company is obviously attracting the most top caliber talent. And a lot of that goes into the fact that you guys put a lot into it to make it a quote talent destination, as the podcast goes. What advice would you give to younger companies who want to be able to do something like that?
So I think it really comes down to your overall business's strategy. So we've set up a lot of ways that we operate, and I'm not going to sugarcoat it here. All business decisions come with pros and cons. We operate 100% remote. We operate in a space that typically attracts quote unquote younger talent. Not that we're like ageist, but digital marketing didn't really start until the late 2000s. So, and a lot of people that got into it were early in their career at that point. So a lot of people that work at our company are somewhere between the ages of 25 and 40. And a lot of people that were more all further along in their career when this stuff started to evolve didn't go back, quote unquote, backwards and learn a lot of it. So it attracts a younger demographic that also pairs nicely with remote work. So those are a couple of key like business strategy decisions. I think that there's a huge element of like you sort of attract what people see or are looking for. Maybe I can say that in a little bit more clear way. A lot of the people that come and work at my company see all the problems that I talk about inside of their own, the company they work at right now. And then maybe they hear about it and they try and move companies before they move to a different company and they run into all the same challenges. And then they realize that if they want to do something different, then they might need to change the target company of what they're looking for. So we attract a lot of people that have been through that sort of cycle. I call it the MQL hamster wheel, or where marketing is a sales assistant mainly that's focused on MQLs or things like that. And eventually smart people realize, hey, this stuff is dumb. There's way better things that we could be doing. I want to innovate and do things that our customers want today. I need to go and find an organization where I can do those things. And so we attract people that see a lot of those problems that tend to be forward thinking, highly intelligent, people that challenge the status quo or are not comfortable with complacency. And so a lot of those things end up attracting the type of talent that you're looking for. So I think that it like basically like mission, leadership, product are three core things that are going to determine which type of talent you attract. And so I think focusing on a couple as a business leader, focusing on those things and understanding if these are the sort of dynamics of our leadership, mission, product, then what type of people are going to be attracted to that mission. And you'll sort of understand what type of people, and your culture is basically an accumulation of the behaviors of the leaders and executives, what behaviors are tolerated or not at the leadership level, and then what types of people that you attract into your company. That's basically how culture is built.
All right, let's get tactical. If marketers are on the job hunt now and they're tuning in, what kind of questions should they ask when it comes to vetting an organization's true mindset into marketing? And what kind of flags should they watch out for?
So this is a real tough one because honestly, like, if you're looking for a company that does innovative stuff and does things differently, the pool of companies that are available to you is actually very small. In the grand scheme of things, is very small. And a lot of companies will tell you a story on the way in about how they're, you know, you're going to take charge and you're going to be able to do new things. And, you know, we can't wait to get into dark social and blah, blah, blah. And then you get in there and 2 months later, you got 5,000 MQL target and you're back doing all the same dumb shit that you did at your last company.
Yep.
And that's happened to me before. I'm sure that happens to a lot of people. And so I think that there's a couple of key factors that I would look at. The first factor is how do they measure the success of marketing right now? That'll tell you very clearly. And I would dig deeper because a lot of people are going to say, we measure the success of marketing on revenue. That's like, then I would dig deeper and say, okay, how do you determine how much revenue and how does that mean for success? And then you might peel back the layers and realize that it's just about how much revenue is generated from the leads sourced by marketing. And then you can tell you're going to be on the MQL hamster wheel again. I would look at whether they have business leaders inside of their company that are active on social platforms. If they're active on social platforms, then it means that they have some level of understanding about how buyers buy today. I'd be looking specifically at the marketing leader and understanding what is the perspective of this marketing leader. Are they forward thinking? Are they doing, do they have a community strategy? What's their virtual event strategy? Are they just producing blogs and SEO content? Or are they thinking about new things? How does budget get allocated? And that's an interesting signal. And then the last one that some people might push back on me on, this is anecdotal to be clear, but it feels like working at, especially if you're in venture land, that finding companies that are a little bit more later stage increases the probability of your success. And this is anecdotal, but a lot of Series A and B companies, you got all of the issues that other companies have about how do you measure marketing, how do you do attribution, sales and marketing alignment. Then you also have this huge other thing of like, we don't know who we're selling to yet. We don't have traction in the market. We don't know what vertical to target. We don't have a defined, well-oiled sales process. And you introduce this whole other variable into the mix that really compromises the chances of success. Is the upside higher if you join a Series A or B company? For sure. Getting in earlier for career growth and promotions and equity. Yes, the upside is higher in A's and B's, but your likelihood of success also goes way down. And so, you know, targeting a company that's later stage, late B, C, D, some of that time, you're going to be joining a marketing team that's probably 20 to 50 people instead of 1 to 5 people. You might have to take a senior manager role instead of a, you know, director or senior director role at a company where you're the only marketer. But I think the amount of learning that you have will go up. The probability of success will go up. The learning from just seeing how a company that's growing, that has, you know, good product, you know, good product traction, has a great customer success motion, has a good executive team, the learnings of joining a more developed organization can pay off really high in your next career opportunities or future career. So those are a couple of the things that I would look at.
I love that answer. And I totally agree with all of the points that you mentioned. You guys are privately funded, which is cool. You guys don't have to focus on making your next round all the time. What are the benefits to that to employees?
So I think that there are pros and cons to the way that we finance the company. When it comes to the pros, is that we can set goals that are appropriate to the business, not what investors need to see: triple, 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 double, double, 100 million ARR, burn through a bunch of people. It forces you to have strong business fundamentals and unit economics from the beginning. It forces you to find things that actually work from a business standpoint, like having marketing and sales engine that actually works, not just spending 5x more to get customers. I think on the con side, there are some things that other companies can do because they're venture funded and they got someone else's money that they can spend money on that we can't or don't. When we had to do a layoff the past summer, like I wasn't paying severance from the VC's money that was coming out of my bank account to pay severance, hundreds of thousands of dollars. And so like, I think a lot of people don't recognize that when you're privately funded, there's a lot of things that change. There's a lot of sacrifices that I've made in my life to have this company and to bootstrap it and to grow it really quickly and to give people, you know, we pay a minimum salary of $75,000. Our lowest paid salary is $75,000 at our company. There's 27 people at my company that make more money, more salary than I do. There's a lot of things that I've done to try and give this company a lot of the positive things, pay high salaries, give people a lot of benefits that come at the short-term expense for me. And I'm fine with that. I play the long game. I do a lot of things that set us up for success in the long term. But it's hard. It's a hard road. And certainly having someone else give you $5 million that you don't have to pay back in exchange for 15% of your company sometimes could be easier, quote unquote easier. But the way that we operate here is we do things differently. I don't need a VC trying to tell me what to do when we make decisions that are in a 10-year window, not a, you know, next quarter. So it's just based on, if you're a business leader, it's just based on what you think you need. Another thing, we've been developing products inside of our company. A lot of the profits from our company get reinvested into the company. I've taken no money out of this company for 4 years. The profits get reinvested into future product development that supports our, agency and consulting offering, but also future business units that we plan to develop, which has been a strategy all along. So there are, and a lot of other people would have said, hey, let's have someone else run this company, or let's sell this company, and then I'll go and build the soft. I'll sell this company, make $20 million, let everyone just go work for somebody else, and I'll go build this software company. As I reflect on it, there's a lot of pros and cons, and there's a lot of cons that a lot of people don't see.
Okay. I've been having everybody who's come on have an opportunity to debunk an unpopular opinion. So basically, it could be anything that you found on LinkedIn that somebody calls unpopular, and then you look at it and it's just a cop-out. It's not anything. Can you name anything that comes to mind there that you've found?
Can you say that one more time?
Debunk an unpopular opinion that you've heard that somebody has been talking about, maybe on LinkedIn or elsewhere.
Well, I'm about to debunk one in the event that we're coming up next, which is, hey, don't add "how did you hear about us" to your form. It's going to decrease your conversion rates.
I've been told that.
What a lot of marketers say, because they write a report from Optimizely in 2014 or whatever it was published. I'm not even sure it was Optimizely, just to be clear. Some conversion rate optimization software that says, don't add any more forms to your field. It'll decrease conversion rates when you run high volume performance marketing to get people to download your ebook. And the stat is that if you add more forms, it'll decrease your conversion rates without any context, that you're running a ton of paid traffic there, that you're trying to get them to download an ebook, not get into a sales conversation, that it comes from these types of channels and sources, that you're adding these types of fields. And so we've done research. We've added "how did you hear about us" to multiple companies' forms. We've collected that data in A/B tests to sample sizes as great as 436,000 website visits.
Wow.
And determine that there's no statistically significant difference when you add "how did you hear about us" or when it's a required field versus an optional field. So I'll be presenting that data. We publish a lot of our experiment data in a research and advisory offering that we have called The Vault. And so that is one thing that I'm looking forward to. And like basically what we're spending our time on right now is running experiments and generating real data to either prove or disprove, right? Like the point of an experiment is not to just validate what you already think. It's actually get the data and understand, is it true or is it not? And be able to quote unquote debunk or not debunk things that people believe, but won't actually do the research for themselves to understand whether or not it's true. So that's really what my company's focused on now, to generate this level of data, to give marketers and executive teams the confidence to do things that are not generally accepted right now or seem like not best practices. That'll be presented in about 30 minutes from now.
I know a lot of marketers are going to be happy to have this soundbite to show to the people who are telling them that they can't add that to a form, because I have been told that more than one time now, that if I added that, then we're going to have less conversions because we are asking them for too much information. And it's been annoying not to have actual data to back that up. I'm glad that you did that.
Yeah, exactly. And we'll do more of it.
All right. Well, I don't think I need to ask anybody about this, but where should people go to find you besides LinkedIn, TikTok?
Yeah, on all socials, Chris Walker 171, specifically LinkedIn, TikTok, YouTube. And then just following the Revenue Vitals podcast is great. And if you want to sign up for the digital events that we do, you can visit refinelabs.com. You can find the registration link and you can attend the events we do every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern.
All right. Well, hey, thank you so much for coming on my show.
Thanks for having me. It was such a blast. Appreciate you inviting me.
I had an amazing time. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Unpopular Opinion. This episode was produced by Audience Ops, a content-led growth agency. If you're looking for help launching a podcast, Audience Ops handles all the legwork, so you can focus on providing the subject matter expertise. If you enjoyed this episode, please follow Ashley's show on Spotify, Apple, or YouTube.